ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming. We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doogue, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
10, 9, 8, 7. We have a go for main engine start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We have booster ignition and liftoff of Space Shuttle Columbia with a multitude of national and international space research experiments.
Every time I was there to cover a shuttle launch, I was scared to death. I spent the whole time thinking about what on earth would I say if the craft exploded right in front of me. That's basically something you have to reckon with as part of the job.
On January 16, 2003, CNN aerospace correspondent Miles O'Brien had a front row seat as the Space Shuttle Columbia launched into space for a 16-day mission. Despite his apprehension,
everything seemed to go according to plan.
Columbia now rolling on to the proper azimuth for a 39-degree inclination to orbit. Shuttle in a heads-down, wings-level position for the 8.5-minute ride to orbit.
8.5 minutes after it leaves the launch pad, everybody's tucked in safely in space, and everybody, including myself, breathes a sigh of relief. You know, the conventional wisdom at the time was that was the most dangerous part of the mission, the launch.
At that point, Miles remembers taking off his microphone and earpiece and walking back to his trailer to speak to his producer.
And he was playing back a piece of footage which NASA had been replaying about, you know, a minute and a half after launch.
And it was this piece of footage that caught their attention.
I'd never seen anything like it. It was like this kind of explosion of confetti or something, or somebody had dropped a bag of flour on the floor. And we went back and forth looking at what was happening on the leading edge of that left wing. And it was very alarming when I saw it, because I had never seen anything quite like it. I had covered upwards of 50 space shuttle launches at that point. And so I immediately started calling my sources.
Now, Miles and his producer weren't the only ones to notice this strike. But when he reached out to his contacts at NASA, he was told,
I wouldn't worry about it a bit. We're not concerned. It's not that big a deal.
And the thing was that in January 2003, there were some other major news events playing out.
The U.S. was in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, and I had been assigned several duties and tasks to help tell that story. And my bosses at CNN wanted me to focus on that. And so, frankly, I lost sight of that story. I will take to my grave regret for not pushing that story. I don't know that it would have changed anything, but it might have.
This is The Challenger Legacy, a five-part series of science fiction from ABC Radio National. I'm Dr. Carl.
And I'm Fiona Pepper. In the first two episodes of this series, we covered the disastrous launch of the Space Shuttle Challenger.
Now, in episode three, we're jumping forward 17 years to the year 2003, to another disaster.
This is episode three, Columbia.
Can you hear me?
The voice you're hearing is Laurel Clark, one of the seven astronauts selected for the STS-107 mission of the Space Shuttle Columbia. In this recording, she's speaking to her husband, John Clark, and their son, Ian, from on board the Space Shuttle.
Good chat, Mom.
Thanks, Tater Tot. And I can't tell you how much I'm thankful for both of your love and especially for you getting up so early to come in and see me.
The Columbia crew made it safely to orbit, and John and Ian then went about their lives as normally as they could. And once a week during the 16-day mission, they got to speak to Laurel via this very grainy video conference call.
What I realized is that this was really Ian's time. And so most of the time, we had 10 or 15 minutes, was spent with Ian and Laurel talking about different things. You know, like she would do the classic thing where she would throw the M&Ms out there and then she would come in and eat them in different upside down positions and, you know, fun stuff like that.
Yeah, I know. Do you want to see me do another M&M, Ian? Okay, it's going to come toward my mouth.
The vacuum of space.
The vacuum of mom.
So Laurel and John met in the late 1980s at Navy Dive School and married a couple of years after that. They were both physicians in the Navy, and then they ended up working for NASA. John says when the launch of Columbia finally happened after a series of delays, it was very, very exciting.
I had been to quite a few launches to support the crew as a crew surgeon or deputy crew surgeon or support staff. So I had seen a lot of launches up close. They are highly emotionally charged. They're really, really exciting. The thing about it is it's a tremendous amount of chemical stored energy that's being released in essentially a controlled explosion.
But this launch was different. Laurel was on board, and John and Laurel's 8-year-old son, Ian, was watching live.
He was very emotional. First of all, he's a mommy's boy, and so he didn't want his mommy to go. And, you know, he was kind of more upset than anything else that she was going. So I was trying to cheer him up about, you know, hey, this is great and wonderful. And it was a beautiful day. It was perfect. It was absolutely the most perfect launch, you know, ever.
It's torture when you're gone. Well, I'm going to be home soon. You're going to come down to Florida? Snuggle with me when I get off the spaceship?
No, I completely forgot.
John and Ian didn't know it, but this would be one of the last times they spoke to Laurel, because the space shuttle she was on, in orbit above the Earth, had major damage.
Fondly described as the old grey lady of the NASA fleet, 28 missions, the first completed in 1981. Over the years, it had more than 1,500 modifications made to it, decreasing the number of tiles it had covering its surface to deal with the extreme heat of space travel.
I spent a lot more time with Columbia than the other vehicles, tracking the problems, tracking the systems from flight to flight.
That's Mike Cinelli. From the mid-90s, Mike worked as the Columbia Integration Systems Engineer, preparing the vehicle for launch. So he was very familiar with that particular space shuttle.
Each of the vehicles are very similar. There are little differences, you know, little quirks, if you will, like your cars all have a little different things. So she was a little heavier than the rest of the vehicles. It was the first vehicle built, so built with a little more instrumentation on board, a little more weight.
Columbia was the oldest of the space shuttles. It was the vehicle used in the very first launch of the space shuttle program back in 1981. So by 2003, it was more than 20 years old.
But despite that, Mike says...
So the structure was good. The systems were good. Of course, they're always continually updated, modified, or fixed as need be. But Columbia was older, but not... There was nothing systemic about its age contributing to any concerns for its safety or reliability.
So January 2003, Columbia takes off, and people inside NASA and reporters too notice this thing that we've heard about, what looks like a bag of flour bursting. It turns out that this was something called a foam strike, and this was a well-known issue with shuttle launches.
Since the first flights of the space shuttle, we had foam coming off the external tank, which is that large orange tank, fuel tank that's attached to the orbiter. It had been happening for... like I said, since the earliest days. The space shuttle design requirements was that no debris should be shedded from the tank. They could strike the thermal protection system, which is the belly of the ship. That was requirements, but we had seen that from the beginning.
Oh my heavens, in hindsight, that is really alarming that they'd actually been seeing it all the way along from the very earliest missions. Now, the foam, well, the foam on the tank was to stop the heat from the outside world getting in and warming up the liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen, and make it boil off too soon, and also stopping it from getting covered in ice, which could also fall off. Now, like most insulation, it was incredibly lightweight. It was polyurethane, like the foam you find in a mattress or in the box when you unpack your TV from the shop. But chunks of it coming off and hitting the orbiter, well, that's a worry.
Yeah, that's right. That's why the design requirement was for no foam debris, because the protective surface was so important for the shuttle to safely come back to land. So when engineers saw those foam strikes happening, Mike says they would check for damage after the shuttle came back to Earth.
I'd look up at the belly of the ships, and you'd see sometimes there would be very little damage. So in other words, if you had a tile, which is like a ceramic-coated, a smooth surface, sometimes you'd see the tiles nearly intact. And sometimes you see them pitted. You'd see like little wormholes-looking objects. We got comfortable with having safe and successful flights with that level of damage.
Throughout NASA, there was this belief, based on experience, that these foam strikes during launch weren't really much of a concern, even though it was a design requirement that no debris was to be shed.
Yes, because as Mike says, they had seen this during nearly every single launch the shuttles had made. So when the agency's cameras picked up the foam hitting the leading edge of the Columbia's left wing, that bag of flour moment that we keep coming back to, many within NASA weren't worried. Columbia engineer Mike Cinelli says that after Columbia made it to space, he first heard about the foam strikes as if it was no big deal.
And the next day, I remember walking to the office, and one of our gray beards, a gentleman that's been there for a long time, walked up to me and said, looks like we took a hit on the way up the hill, which means something struck the vehicle, we believe. And it was really as nebulous as that. Didn't really know what it was, how big it was, but it wasn't felt with a sense of major concern at that point at all.
Which is essentially what CNN journalist Miles O'Brien was told.
To a person, they all said, oh, this has been happening since day one. I wouldn't worry about it a bit. We're not concerned. It's not that big a deal.
And for John Clark, both a NASA employee and husband of a Columbia crew member, it was an issue he remembers learning about at work, midway through the mission.
I was working in mission control on the mission, and I found out about the foam strike. And I remember talking to one of my colleagues and going, wow, that's interesting. We've had foam strikes before, but this was a big one. You know, it was a huge piece of foam. Upper management said, no, it's not an issue. Put it to rest. And the crew was told on flight day 8, which was about halfway into the mission, that, hey, there was this discussion about foam. And the only reason we're telling you is in case the press asks you, you can just say, hey, it's no big deal.
Were there people within the agency who were worried?
Yes, there absolutely were.
There were people at various levels in NASA who were extremely concerned about what they saw, because while foam had been falling off that fuel tank since day one, this was much bigger than anybody had seen before.
That piece of foam that fell off the external fuel tank during the launch of Columbia in January 2003, they say was about the size of a briefcase and weighed around 700 grams. And from the launch footage, it was clear that the piece of foam had struck the edge of the left wing of the shuttle.
And there were people at the lower levels of engineering who were trying to elevate their concerns, and they were being thwarted by NASA senior management.
Wow, I'm getting memories of Challenger here. So this is kind of sounding like familiar territory again, engineers versus management.
Yeah, concerns raised, pushback from above. There are definitely similarities. Now, it wasn't going to be easy to get images of the outside of the vehicle to check for damage, but it was possible.
They could have called up the various three-letter agencies in the United States, National Security Agency, you name it, National Signals Intelligence Agency. The people who run U.S. spy satellites had more than enough capability to zoom in on that shuttle leading edge wing and could have seen if there was damage. And there were people at NASA asking the upper management of the shuttle program, the mission management team as it is called, to do just that, and they refused to do it.
The engineers were worried that the briefcase-sized foam piece had punched a hole in the left wing of the shuttle. And if that was the case, the wing wouldn't be protected against the extreme temperatures of re-entry. And then, just as scheduled, on February 1st, 2003, Space Shuttle Columbia began its return to Earth.
It was a perfect day for the launch, and it was a perfect day for the landing. I mean, absolutely stunningly perfect.
John Clark and his son Ian were at Cape Canaveral alongside the other families of the crew to watch the re-entry.
We're on these kind of like athletic bleachers there, you know, on the hill right where the shuttle lands. So you got a really great view of it.
John says all of the families were chatting away, excited to see their loved ones.
And usually about 2-3 minutes ahead of time, you hear the sonic booms. You always hear them. When the shuttle comes in overhead, when it's a pretty loud one, it sets off the car alarms in the parking lot. I mean, if you're not ready for it, it's like distressing, but you know that sound is good. And the clock's ticking down and it's like, where's the sonic boom? Because, you know, it's got to be there like 2 minutes beforehand. And it's not. And so I knew something was up then. Then that was just like, well, they went somewhere else. They're going to bail out somewhere. That was my default.
Now, for every mission, NASA has dedicated family escorts. They're astronauts that accompany the crew's family, basically in the case of an incident.
And all their phones started going off at the same time, and it was really weird. And so all of a sudden, it's like we're rushed to the cars, and there's no what's going on or anything else. It's just get in the car. We're heading back to the crew quarters.
Not long after arriving at the crew quarters, John says the families received the worst possible news.
And he says, we don't have absolute confirmation on it, but from what we can tell, the shuttle broke up over Texas. And then there was just massive wails and cries. It was really, it was kind of one of the most, I would say the most horrific thing I've ever heard in my life. Almost like, you know, animal screams, wails.
What was going through your head in those hours afterwards?
It was kind of like, I didn't know that at the time, but I was thinking, well, maybe if they got lower and slower, they might have been able to bail out. I mean, you always have to have some hope. Yeah.
This day has brought terrible news and great sadness to our country. At 9 o'clock this morning, Mission Control in Houston lost contact with our Space Shuttle Columbia. A short time later, debris was seen falling from the skies above Texas. The Columbia's lost. There are no survivors.
The families were brought back from the Kennedy Space Center that morning, right after. And I was responsible for Laurel Clark's family. So I went to the airport when they landed and received her son, her 8-year-old son. And while they whisked the parents away, so they needed somebody to take care of the kids.
That's Julie Payette, an astronaut and close friend of Laurel Clark. She was a family escort on the day of the Columbia disaster.
We took Ian with other astronauts who had kids that Ian knew and that were about the same age because we thought that maybe that would help. And we took him to a familiar place to eat and everything. And he would sometimes come back. They were playing. And take a French fry from his plate and say, you know, my mom died today. And we, the colleagues, we would look at each other, and really, we did not know what to say. out of control because it was, how do you process that when you're eight? And I think he was very, very, very angry at life that he had been dealt this terrible thing.
Despite what had happened to the space shuttle Columbia and its crew, John Clark says he'd have always supported his wife going to space.
Part of it is, who am I to say don't go? Because I would, if I was in her shoes, I would still go. In fact, I used to have dreams after the shuttle mishap. I would have a dream where she was taking too long to get in her spacesuit, and I said, oh, just let me go. And I put the suit on and went. And I remember looking out, you know, not that you would necessarily see the wing falling off, but I remember, you know, seeing the wing, you know, burning through. I would have dreams about where I would take her place instead.
Space travel has undeniable risks. And yet, in the aftermath of this second disaster, for some people, the similarities between Challenger and Columbia were as clear as day.
These disasters were essentially avoidable.
This is the saddest part of this accident to me, is it's if you substitute foam for O-rings, it's the same story.
So, nearly two decades, 20 years after the Challenger disaster, people were left asking the same question. Could this have been prevented?
How could this have happened again? And between disasters, had NASA changed?
As you explore these different accidents and incidences, there are so many of these lessons that come out, but they keep repeating themselves. If we don't learn them now, we're going to do it again.
Because it did happen again.
The questions were, how do you as a crew feel about the fact that foam fell off of your fuel tank when that was the same thing that caused the Columbia accident and it was supposed to be fixed? And now it happened to you. Aren't you angry about that?
And that's coming up on episode 4 of The Challenger Legacy.
Science fiction, The Challenger Legacy, was made for ABC Radio National on the lands of the Gadigal and Menang Noongar people. It's reported and presented by me, Fiona Pepper.
And with me, Carl Krzelnitsky. The show's senior producer is James Bullen, and our sound engineer is Timothy Jenkins.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.